Hello friends, and welcome again to Root to the Right, the regular reactionary reading review regarding recommended reading written by White Wing types. On this episode, I'm joined by Mick, who's back from the land of sun and steel. How was it, Mick?
It's fantastic, and it's a pleasure to be here as always.
Wonderful. And Demok, who's got a shiny new mic, let's hear it.
Once again, a pleasure.
Fantastic. And we've got a very special guest for you this time, ladies and gents, none other than Sheepdog. So, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Sheepdog, so I just hang around and show up when I'm not needed.
Fantastic. So, as usual, I'm Thumos, trying to keep the whole ship on the road. Yeah, that didn't work. And I've got to give some apologies to for Bronze, but he'll be reappearing next episode. So what are we doing this time, lads? We're looking into Michel Houellebecq? Is it Houellebecq?
Houellebecq.
Houellebecq.
Oh, I think Houellebecq. It's Houellebecq.
Holy barbecue.
Michel Holy barbecue.
Houellebecq.
Houellebecq. Yeah. It's all the... it'd get you a hell of a score in Scrabble. So Michel Houellebecq and his work, we're going to be reviewing his book from 2019, Serotonin. You're going to listen to some music, have a chat about that, and then there'll be our usual segment of the call to action coming back after BAP's big exhortation. So we'll, I guess, start out by diving in. There won't be any spoilers in this first part, but when we get into the book proper, we're going to be doing a bit of a deep dive. So you will, if you want to go and read the book first and then come back, I'd really recommend it because we're going to go through some pretty major plot points. But first, who is this Michel Holy Barbecue? So Sheepdog, you were the one who turned us onto this book. Why do you do this?
So how I came across Houellebecq was I read Douglas Murray's Strange Death of Europe, and there's a chapter where he goes through different literary works. So he goes through, say, like The Camp of the Saints and a few other things. Now he then goes into Submission, which is by Houellebecq, which is essentially about the Islamic sort of takeover of government in 2022 France. So then I then wanted to read it. So then I read it, and essentially it covers similar characters to what he normally covers, is basically depressed boomers. which is like just a metaphor for sort of Western civilization at the moment, that life really doesn't have much meaning. The current system isn't bringing anyone happiness, and depending on the different works, what the different themes are in the book. So I saw that he was releasing Serotonin, and it was more about, it's more about sort of regional rural communities really feeling the decay and the strain of like free market globalist economic policies, while sort of and then what everything else seeps through then. So you've got, so, you know, people selling up farms, you're not having that sort of generational farm lifestyle being lived out anymore. You're seeing cheap good, like your produce being sent overseas, things coming in from outside. And the interesting thing about this is that Houellebecq gets noted for sort of being a bit of a prophet. So trying to think, so we've got Platform, which was in 2001, which is about a terrorist attack in Thailand. Now in 2002 there were the Bali bombings. Submission, 2015. Later on, an Al-Qaeda-like group attacks Charlie Hebdo. Now you have Serotonin, which, not going to get into spoilers yet, but he started writing this before the Yellow Vest movement. So that's how I know about Houellebecq. Yeah, and if you look at actual photos of the bloke, he generally looks like the characters he writes about. Yeah,
I think one of the takeaway points in most of the reading that I've done about him, and a lot of the criticisms have been leveled at it, is that his characters are basically like either autobiographical or semi-autobiographical. It's pretty clear. And especially with his first book, they reckon that it was pretty much, he was just writing about how shit it was trying to be an up-and-coming poet in France.
Well, he gave an interview about his new book, and he says writing is like cultivating parasites in your brain. So that's the kind of guy. Love it.
So he's been called populism's prophet as a result. This sort of ability to be prescient and seemingly predict events that are coming up, for better or worse. Most of the time, let's face it, it's for worse. Welbeck's not exactly the cheeriest guy. So we're not going to be dropping too many white pills, but we'll try and keep it pretty funny for those of you playing at home. So Welbeck attended an agricultural college. Like Florent, who's the main character in Serotonin. So his first book I found out in 1991 was a critical study of P. Lovecraft. Any Lovecraft fans on the show?
I love me some Cthulhu.
Yeah, don't mind some Lovecraft.
Some which?
What?
Some bit of Lovecraft.
Oh, cool.
Some Harry Potter. that's Lovecraft, isn't it?
I've got no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, what's this Harry Potter?
Yeah, I think he did, Lovecraft did The Order of the Phoenix. Is that right?
Yeah, that's probably Lovecraft.
Keep going.
Yeah, I think there's a quote from an article in The Atlantic, not the most lauded outlet, but we can get into it, which says, quote, Welbeck has not given any interviews since Serotonin debuted, but he recently published an essay in Harper's Magazine praising Donald Trump, especially his free trade policies and his dislike of the European Union. Welbeck said, Europe is just a dumb idea that has gradually turned into a bad dream from which we shall eventually wake up. Later in the same article, it said, quote, though pretty terrible on women, Welbeck is better on economics. The narrator of Serotonin is hyper aware of product names and doesn't seem to find happiness among the 20 brands of hummus available at his local supermarket, a message that consumer society is spiritually unfulfilling. He also remarks at one point on the fact that some Parisians can earn more money renting out their inherited apartments than they would be by actually having jobs. The tension between inherited wealth and generated income is one of the key questions for the French economy today. End quote. Yeah, we're going to link that article in the show notes, but that take was pretty good. He talks in Serotonin about not only his own apartment and that whole real estate thing or whatever, one of the other characters, without spoiling too much, basically has done that for years. Just stuck around in their apartment, hoping that it'll appreciate in value enough for them to eventually cash in their chips. Did you catch that partnership, Doug?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I suppose I can't spoil it, but he's his friend out in the countryside.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, that's and also one of the lady friends close to the city.
Yeah.
So just, you know, I guess for the first little part of the show that we've got here, assuming everyone, obviously, bar Mick, has read the book, what were your kind of key takeaway to start out with?
Well, it gets into sort of how politicians will fight to the death for sort of free trade, but when it comes to actually defending the interests of the country, they're kind of absent in terms of rhetoric. Now sort of like his sort of views on women and like what he sees around him, like it's almost like an authentic thought he's having. So like you go, like, it's not really a spoiler because it's like the first chapter in the book, but like just his opinions on when he sees like the beautiful Spanish hippie girls. It's just like that's probably what a man that age in that kind of mindset is thinking at the time. He's thinking of just how sexy they are the whole time.
Yeah.
So I found it very real. It's incredibly depressing, but someone with depression actually does think like that. So I found it really good. It's my takeaway initially.
Cool. Yeah. What about you, Demar?
Just for the start of the book.
Oh, just the whole book in general, but just give us that kind of broad brush.
Well, the way I looked at it, it's sort of a character study, but the character in a way represents the whole of France and in another way the rest of the Western world, I suppose. It explores it through, after this, I'm going to stop using words ending in Uma. That's my challenge for the podcast outside of this sentence. He is a boomer, doomer, coomer.
Pretty much. Consumer.
And a consumer. That's All right, so I'm allowed to be kicked from the chat, or just like cheap dog can show up to my house and beat me if I use another word ending in Uma during this. That's my challenge for this. But so it's a character study of this sort of character has really been formed by a world where everything is transactional and running on free trade. His relationships with other people are transactional. Everything he does is transactional and in a sort of impersonal free trade sort of way.
So he's a doomer as well.
He is a doomer. I forgot that one. Mm. Oh, shit. Okay. I'm locking my door because Sheepdog's going to be on his way.
I'm coming. Get in the car right now.
Everything is impersonal and transactional. His with women, he just sort of goes, okay, you give me sex and I'll give you whatever. He only has a few male friends. He has one actual male friend, and towards the end, he sort of sees doctors as the closest thing he has to friends because he can talk to them, even though it's in a transactional, impersonal, medical sort of way.
Mm.
It's like he floats through life alone and just has transactions with people.
It's
just sort of floating through a free market. It makes a point several times that he's got an inheritance but no actual roots. He's it's just sort of bleak and empty for him.
Does he have children?
No.
No.
He has two chances at true love, which he messes up by various failures, but among them is that worldview.
Yeah, I think your point about the transactional nature of so many of his relationships and the rest of it, that's really it's really insightful. I hadn't thought about that too much myself, but now that you mention it, there's only really one example through the whole book that I can think of that isn't like that. And even then, he seems to be really uncomfortable with the connection that, and it's not too much of a big spoiler to bring this up, but do you remember closer towards the end, he's staying in a hotel for a time. And then when he comes back to the hotel, the receptionist remembers him. And they kind of have that. And eventually when he leaves the hotel, I guess for the last time, the same receptionist, I can't remember a name offhand, but he sort of describes their interactions and thinking that there might have been something there, or, you know, there's some sort of interpersonal thing that's genuine. And he seems to be quite struck and uncomfortable by it. And I thought that was pretty telling for the character. Yeah, that's a really good take, Stamok. Do you remember that part?
Yeah, in that part of the book, I only just read it because I ended up having to smash out half the thing today. towards the end, it shows that after he's had all these transactional relationships, he does get shown human kindness once or twice.
Like
his doctor, the one that actually gives him the medication, really does try to steer him on a better path. He pushes him away, and then this girl does that, and he pushes her away. He's sort of shut himself in. He's sort of resigned. It's like he's addicted to the free market, and he can't make these connections anymore. Through the book, he's talking about how it's so bad this free market is screwing over the farmers, and it's horrible, and Ireland and Argentina and Poland are all coming in and throwing it in. But then he'll go off and sleep with a series of brown women and praise a supermarket for having a wide variety of hummus, which he loves so much. It's like a boomer, which has just gone, yeah, you can get a pie wife and you can get all the good food, and it's bad when people get screwed over for it. But I like my Thai wife and my 20 types of hummus at once.
Yeah.
It's like he's got that boomer disconnect in his head where he sees the bad things in his own ideology and goes, oh no, so terrible, but doesn't associate it. He just tosses it out.
Yeah, so I'll try not to tread the same territory in my takes, but I thought it was quite interesting noting the, it's not a central role, but obviously the title of the book is serotonin. So serotonin is that neurotransmitter that gives you the sort of feeling of satisfaction or happiness, you know, a sense of contentment. And there's precious little of that in the whole book. And there's other sort of pharmacological stuff that comes up. And it characterizes a lot of his interactions with other people and himself. And it's not spoiling too much to say that pretty much, literally the opening of the book is him starting to take this drug, which is, you know, based on real drugs, but it's not an actual drug, called Captorix. And I thought that it was kind of notable just to watch the progression in that and to see the impacts that these substances have coupled with the lifestyle and the rest of it that you've described, Demok, you know, has on him personally and his outlook, both, I guess, just as a human being and as a kind of man, whatever that is for him. And the other take that I got that we haven't really touched on so far is I found that talking about the sexual liberation in the book, for what it's worth, and the kind of degeneracy and the rest of it that it really alarmingly leads to in his own attitudes and in things that he uncovers about people around him. Yeah, it's sort of, he really lays bare the fact that that kind of liberation and sexual freedoms and the rest of it have resulted in basically just creating a marketplace of sexuality between people that is transactional in nature and only defined by the levels of degeneracy to which it proceeds, you know? And it's meant that so many people are just devoid of being able to have real relationships with one another, particularly as they get into later stages of their life when everyone, quote unquote, has, you know, been around the block a bit. Did you find the same thing at all, Sheepdog or Demok?
Oh, about the sexual relationships. Mm. Well, I think his relationship with the girlfriend who he's with at the beginning of the book is entirely that. Like, so, they both despise each other, but are still together because she obviously provides some sort of sexual, you know, gratification to him.
Yeah.
And she gets to live a that kind of lifestyle in Paris. So that it's a transactional relationship that isn't actually built upon, you know, love, trust, and all the good shit, basically.
Family structure and the rest of it. The other kind of broad brush take, did you have anything to mark? Sorry.
Yeah, I think that just really takes it to another level in terms of it really highlights that this free market mentality is taken over every part of his life, right down to the sex and his relationships with people.
Thanks to the fantastic work of Dr. E. Michael Jones, we now understand that sexual liberation is a cudgel or a weapon to be used against us. That was kind of like a semi-quote from Dave Riley. If any of you have been in the news cycle recently and seen the Toilet Paper USA events, you may remember that statement.
It's good.
It's
actually great that that's happening at the exact same time we covered this book.
Yeah. It's Welbeck's working his magic. Good on your holy barbecue. So the only other take that I had was the other broad, I suppose, not too much, was it's a kind of study about interrelationships of power and powerlessness and how, whatever you want to call it, you know, neoliberalism, capitalism, democracy, globalization, bureaucracy under the EU has rendered so many utterly powerless to their own condition and funneled any sort of real power to affect change to an increasingly small kind of cohort of people towards the top, of which Florent occupies for a time in his career almost, or is sort of to one side of that. But overall, yeah, the book looks at people across that whole spectrum, you know, people who are within the cultural and social elite and people who are just trying to struggle on their ancestral farmland. But that was a really interesting part and sort of foreshadowing the IRL formation and rise and rebellion of the Yellow Vest movement or the Gilets Jaunes. That was, yeah, really interesting for me to notice and to see. It's kind of a study into what the motivations and origin of that really were like on the ground, which I didn't know too much about before reading the book, and I've since looked into it a bit more.
What's interesting, especially there, is that he chose to make the protagonist the insider EU bureaucrat.
Yeah, kind of.
Has the exploration of how he is rich and decadent. He's got his own inheritance. He's had power for a while. Though he had good intentions at one point, the system wouldn't let him get him through. He failed personally. And his failure at his pencil-pushing job, where it was just sort of working in an office, had actually led to real pain for the farmers. Because yes. Actually, later in the book, he goes there, and his failure in his project to sell cheese has been leading to drug addiction and suicide in their community because he couldn't deliver.
Yeah. So I suppose we're getting into the more spoilery takes and bits of it now. So we'll dive into the review proper in just a minute. Did you have any other kind of broad stuff you wanted to throw in there? Mick, did you have any takes?
A lot of what you said sort of reminded me of an article that's kind of old hat that I read now recently, and it was published June 13 this year. And the title of that article is called "Wartime Production Levels in Peacetime with This One Weird Trick That Destroys the Human Soul." If you Google that, you should be able to find it straight away at the top of the search results. But it sort of outlines the very sort of like the rise to this sort of consumer system, and how some certain uncle of ours in the mid 20th century almost sort of exited the whole doomed cycle of existence that we now lead. But that screwed up. So I don't know. It's worth a read. I sort of drew a lot of connotations with what you were saying earlier. Of course, I haven't read the book because I'm a Zoomer and I don't have the time preference for that sort of thing. But it just reminded me.
Nice. Well, we'll definitely chuck that in the show notes for everybody, and also all of the other sort of articles and things that we've read.
It's also got a funny name, so you should just read it because of that.
Oh yeah, just read the headline and share it straight away.
Mm.
Just argue about it. Yeah. So we'll throw all that stuff in the show notes as well. I think now's probably a good time if we want to inject a little break, and then we'll come back and dive into the review of Serotonin.
Copy that.
I've had some good burgers in my time. I love a good Swiss, melted Swiss cheese and roasted mushrooms and caramelized onions on a burger. That is hot stuff on a burger. You can get that at a number of different places. I love a good Swiss, melted Swiss cheese and roasted mushrooms and caramelized onions. I've had some good burgers in my time. That is hot stuff on a burger. You can get that at a number of different places. I've had some good burgers in my time. I love a good Swiss, melted Swiss cheese and roasted mushrooms and caramelized onions on a burger. That is hot stuff. You can get that at a number of different places. Caramelized onions on a burger. hot stuff on a burger. You can get that at a number of different places.
So here we are, the review proper of Serotonin by Michelle Houellebecq. So I'll kick you off. Obviously, there's going to be quite a few spoilers in this. We're going to be chatting about the book in detail. If you haven't read it, I'd recommend going and doing that first and then coming back. If you're happy for us to butcher it for you, then yeah, listen along. So I'll start out with just reading the publisher's description of the book, and then we'll all dive in with our own takes. So this is from Macmillan Publishers. It said, quote, Michelle Houellebecq's Serotonin is a caustic, frightening, hilarious, raunchy, offensive, and politically incorrect novel about the decline of Europe, Western civilization, and humanity in general. Deeply depressed by his romantic and professional failures, the aging hedonist and agricultural engineer, Florent Claude Leboust, feels he is dying of sadness. He hates his young girlfriend, and the feeling is almost certainly mutual. His career is pretty much over, and he has to keep himself thoroughly medicated to cope with day-to-day life. Suffocating in the rampant loneliness, consumerism, hedonism, and sprawl of the city, Leboust decides to head for the hills, returning to Normandy, where he once worked promoting regional cheeses and where he was once in love, and even, it now seems, happy. There he finds a countryside devastated by globalization and by European agricultural policies, and encounters farmers longing, like Leboust himself, for an impossible return to a simpler age. As the farmers prepare for what might be an armed insurrection, it becomes clear that the health of one miserable body and of a suffering body politic are not so different, and that all parties may be rushing toward a catastrophe that a whole drugstore's worth of antidepressants won't make bearable. End quote. That was a pretty good intro.
Yeah, fair intro.
Yeah. So beginning at the beginning, Leboust kicks off the book by telling us how he starts his morning. So he kind of gets up, turns on the old coffee machine and drops his Captorix. So this antidepressant, or they don't go into exactly what the drug is, but this drug that his business prescribed. Yeah, I mean, they come out with that many
antidepressants, it could be real. So who knows?
Yeah, it's probably
real. They all have names like the elves at Lord of the Rings. So it's just like, yeah.
On the name thing, It's spelt C-A-P-T-O-R-I-X. I thought that was a deliberate inclusion, maybe a little cheeky nod from Holy Barbecue to the word captor. Like it's making people slaves. I don't know if that's a really Grug brain take, but there you go. I can recognize words in other words.
A galaxy brain take, to be honest.
So Florent is 46. I don't know if he's younger or older than Houellebecq, but I think the whole book is pretty semi-autobiographical. So the start of the book, they're on holiday in Spain. He and his much younger Japanese wife, Yuzu, who's 26.
Japanese girlfriend.
Sorry, thank you. Yeah, Japanese girlfriend. So they're on holiday in a sort of cheap holiday resort in Spain, is that right?
And she just complains the whole time because it's not good enough for her.
Yeah, she's kind of shady about it. So old mate spends his time getting daytime drunk and getting annoyed at Germans and especially the Dutch, man. Houellebecq really does not like Dutch people.
Yeah, what's it?
I think he accused them of being the free marketist of people at the start.
Yeah, Holland isn't a country. It's a business at best. Yeah,
yeah, I think he rags on them for about, you know, sort of a page and a half. I wouldn't know. I'd listen to the audiobook because I'd butcher the pronunciations. Otherwise, I'm probably still going to. But, he goes after them for, like, a solid time and then kind of finishes up saying, oh, well, you have to simplify sometimes. Otherwise, you end up with nothing. who's sort of defending his like casual French racism. Yeah, people who reserve benches at pools and cheap holiday resorts with towels can, fair enough.
Really like how he does this. Then he gets mad at Yuzu because the Japanese are a bit racist.
It's inside the boomer mind. It's very good. He's got the sort of in that part too, when they're sort of staying in the holiday. Staying in the hotel or the resort or whatever it is. As they're leaving, he kind of makes a real point. I think they moved to another resort or something because Yuzu isn't like the first one or whatever, and she's got this luggage, which he can't even remember the name of, but he paid a huge amount of money for. And he uses the kind of the luggage which doesn't have one of those wheelie things. I promise this anecdote has a point, but he uses the luggage which doesn't have a wheelie thing, so you have to carry it by hand. Mm. So it's like it has to be ported by people, you know, employed to do that. It's very sort of luxe brand. And he uses that to kind of critique, you know, the Spanish and European labor market. He's like, yeah, in Spain, they've still got people for this, but in Europe, it'd be like Barclays. So, yeah, all through the metaphor of this, you know, bougie luggage case that Yuzu's got, which I don't know.
And he compares Yuzu to the Spanish girls he meets along the road sort of thing, about how they're far more beautiful and far more minimalistic.
That particular Spanish guy, I think he just stops to fill up the car or something, and they're just
checking the tire pressure. Yeah,
there we go. And they ask him about the tire pressure, and he just totally has this massive inner monologue and then he continues to refer to them for like the next six chapters. It always goes back to this girl at the service station.
Through is still about that last girl he saw, probably the last woman to give him an erection before he just got moved by antidepressants.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you'll all remember it now. It's the chestnut-haired girl from El Aquila. Yeah, that's it.
Also, yeah. I really love how he still calls the young people who are clearly a bit left hippies, even though it's 2019, just showing his progress a little.
Yeah, yeah. Not once drops a shit lib.
Refer to them as Swipples.
I suppose they were Spanish. I don't know.
Spanish.
But yeah. But it's quite interesting. I think you're right. Yeah, it's probably the last stirrings in his nether regions that he really got. Because the rest of the book, he kind of grumbles around a bit. But yeah, that also talks about driving on the Spanish motorways being incredibly boring, leading to accidents because they are so incredibly boring. I thought that was quite interesting, you know, shadowing again that there's a lack of adrenaline, lack of that kind of real or authentic engagement with your environment, so you just end up killing yourself. It's a very, very Welbeck take.
In that first part, there's a lot of that about how they're slowly getting restricted and reined in, and I think part of him having the massive smoking habit is that.
Mm.
Make a point that he is completely dependent on cigarettes and chain smoke hard. And that actually restricts him because so many places are banning it. It's like the old free world he's used to from being an old person is contracting.
Yeah. It's in this part of the book when he spends, I think he's trying to get a hotel for himself. He's trying to get a hotel for them to move into after the first resort or whatever. And he's looking for one expressly that allows smoking. And it's like a major plot point in the rest of the book as well, that he won't stay somewhere that doesn't allow him to smoke indoors. The note that I wrote for that part was smoke detector boogaloo, because he deliberately disables them. And he's like taught himself how to do it. He tells you in the book how to disable, you know, hotel smoke detectors. But then quotes as well, you know, you can never be safe from betrayal. Talking about hotel staff dobbing him in for smelling like durries.
You know, this book's a lot funnier if you read it with a French accent.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. The audiobook was read by this guy who did an amazing job, but had a very sort of plum English accent.
English accent, yeah.
Yeah. But I could kind of listen to some interviews with Welbeck, so I could fill in the blanks. But there are some quotes where it really comes, like the stuff about the Dutch, the smoke detector thing. I'm like, I can hear the French, you know? Just the indignant shrug.
What he said on the Dutch, a race of opportunist polyglot people. It's just like, fucking hell, man. Jesus.
Wow. Go off, King. So Welbeck's a racist and his character really likes smoking. What else? Did you have anything from that a bit, Demont?
I think most of the thoughts I wrote down were from the second half. So going off memory for this part of the book. But at this point, I'm already calling back to things which will affect him much later, like his one true relationship, which he saw is his one chance at true love. The only non-transactional relationship in the book. That comes up repeatedly. His old girlfriend, Camille.
Yes.
The only woman it seems he actually loved, apart from maybe one other.
And then he finds out she's had a child, and he sort of says, like, yeah, women do that sometimes, don't they, basically. So, yeah. And
walking out, yeah.
Well, there's that inner monologue he has in his head about that he needs to kill the child if he's going to have a chance with Camille.
And yeah, we're jumping way ahead. Like, that bit really got me.
I've jumped ahead, but I'm just like, fuck. Like, it got dark during that bit, like when he's just planning it out just constantly. And it's like,
literally Jesus. Finger on the trigger, like premeditated weeks on a mattress in the fucking woods talking about nearly murdering a four-year-old. Yeah, it was a good book.
I noted from that, we're getting into the part where I actually did have proper notes now. So are we jumping to there or are we going?
I think we should go do.
Yeah, we'll go back. Uzi. We'll go back to where we were. Yeah, we'll jump around a little bit.
Yeah, sorry.
We're trying something new here on Roots of the Right.
I apologize.
We're not all singing from the same hit sheet. The other thing that I took next from the beginning, so they get back to Paris eventually. I don't know. He drives in and manages not to kill them both in the car, but he does say that. He tries. So you remember that part. You know, they're driving back from the holiday and he sort of talks about it. And Welbeck does this really interesting thing with his writing where he lets you in on what's going on in the character's head, in this case, Florent, but doesn't let you know really their intention. So he lets you know what he's sort of observing. Welbeck has this amazing capacity to use very sort of cutting, descriptive, frank, and pretty hilarious language to talk about what's going on around him. And you don't necessarily question the character's motivation. And then you realize what was going on and you're like, oh shit. So he's sort of talking about this boring road, getting back to Paris and, you know, thinking about going for the hard shoulder. He spends a long time talking about the hard shoulder and civil infrastructure, but he's saying, you know, it would be so easy just to let the steering wheel slip, but he didn't. And then that was his first attempt at escaping Yuzu. It's like, whoa, okay. So
his contemplations of suicide and murder start off seeming as sort of little funny jokes, but it just gets darker and more serious as the book goes on.
Yeah.
Like earlier, I was like, ah, yeah, I've written this whole dialogue about considering crashing the car, and it's sort of a bit, like the way he delivered it, it was actually pretty funny, but by the end, it's like serious.
Yeah.
His contemplations of death, of his and others.
So he has this amazing quote coming back into Paris. He says that big cities are, quote, a hell built by human beings at their convenience, end quote. That was really cutting. So they get back home. He and Yuzu have this quite nice apartment, I think. He used the word arrondissement a lot. That's maybe French for block, I don't know. But they live somewhere towards the center of the city, pretty good location. Yuzu's got a job at some sort of uptown cultural institute.
It's just shitty art, basically.
Yeah, bullshit desk fellow cultural attaché thing.
Some of it was like tentacle stuff as well, I believe.
Yes, it was.
He's disgust for it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you've just doubled our listener count there, mate.
Yeah, tentacle porn just fucking all the leaves just hop straight on.
So Florence's first forays into the noble art of rebellion a la Yellow Vest is he revolts against the recycling bins. Did you remember this bit, Mark?
Yeah, that bit was good.
Yeah.
The real accelerationist drives the biggest and dirtiest car he can, like an old late 90s Mercedes G-Wagon.
Yeah.
His diesel 4x4.
Yeah. And throws everything in the green lid and the red lid bin, or the green, I don't know, it depends on where you are.
The quote of the book is, I mightn't have done much good in my life, but at least I contributed to the destruction of the planet. It's like, jeez.
Raised a great point here. Are boomers the ultimate accelerationists?
It reminds me, I don't know if you've seen that new meme that's going around.
So probably the
boomer that's like, oh, you've destroyed everything. And the boomer's just like, how do I turn the front camera on?
It's
funny you should say that, because I suppose the catalyst for the plot of most of the rest of the novel comes up with Florent flexing his technological skills going through Yuzu's email history.
Gee whiz.
Do you want to clue us in as to what he finds, DeMarc? I want to hear you describe it.
It's all in Japanese.
All right, so thinking of how to word this to maximize our addict leadership.
Mm.
I don't know much Japanese, so it's actually really hard.
Kiyosin, bro.
She's you could say she's a white girl at heart.
What does that mean?
She likes dogs.
Oh, okay.
Well, he doesn't find the dogs first.
No, he finds it's a B word, and it rhymes with Akaki. He sees that kind of first, which is not good. And he suspected it for a long time, and he kind of knows it in his heart to be true.
What does it rhyme with? Souvlaki.
Yeah, it rhymes with Souvlaki. Starts with a B and rhymes with Souvlaki. So he sort of goes through email history and finds that out, and, you know, finds out she's been doing it most of their relationship. And,
well,
you know,
he finds out it's early on in the relationship where he actually thought, like, there might have actually been something there, but the whole time she was, you know, having gangbangs in his apartment, being filmed for porn. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the rest, and DeMarc's point, which was very confronting in the book.
Well, the dogs thing really just went, oh, like, he's fucking turned the gas up here. Like, but he sort of compares it just to a Japanese person rooting a European is like rooting a dog anyway. Or something paraphrased.
Yeah, like, he does. Fuck, yeah.
That's pretty pitiful. Yeah, that's just, yeah.
Yeah, no, he really doesn't shy away from the sort of casual racism of any particular ethnicity in the book, or at least their approximation.
Well,
it's like being racist while they're Japanese.
Yeah, well, with Welbeck, it gets mistaken for like bigotry targeted towards specific groups, but it's more just a disgust for the human species itself.
Yeah, I took that away.
Mm.
I don't think it's so much racist as a massive nihilist.
He just hates everyone. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, can you blame
him? It's that. Yeah, it's that event that, I guess, you know, finally tips him over the edge, and he moves out, just basically flies by night on Yuzu. Spends a fair bit of time
Did the picture of Yuzu just remind you of, like, John Lennon's missus, like Yoko Winono or whatever it was? That's just what I imagine she looked like.
I don't know what visualization I had for that. Mm. There's some other characters who came through really clearly, but yeah, probably kind of Yoko type, but... Yoko to me is...
I was imagining the Team America incarnation of Kim Jong-il as Yuzu.
I'm sure Rowe. Yeah.
When it comes to imagining what an Asian woman looks like, there's a very limited range of ways they can look anyway. So.
Thin black hair, wearing a beret, because she's in France. That's about it.
It's the same thing, really. There's no exotic phenology between them. Sorry, Asians. It's true, though. Don't have any.
Oh, there we go. If we had any listeners, they're gone now. Big cheers.
That's close.
That's fine. So Florent moves out. Had enough of Yuzu's affections for. Yep. So on principle, he finds, you know, the one hotel left in Paris that allows smoking inside. This is Paris, right? Which I thought all of them would had to by law, but.
Yeah.
So there's a quote kind of from this bit where he says, you know, he kind of goes on a bit of a look into the relationship dynamics between men and women, and has a very kind of, you know, hand-wavy, smoking French attitude to it, saying, quote, "For women, love is power. Through love, women create new worlds, beginnings. Love for men is an end." It's like, yeah, really, you can see see where you're going with this. Welbeck in real life is onto his third wife, who's also, I think, Chinese. So I don't know. In this semi-autobiographical take, he's not doing himself any favors. I really think maybe he's writing this from his perspective.
He just doesn't give a fuck.
No. Yeah, he really
doesn't. See him writing the whole yuzu bit, then making his Chinese wife proofread it for him just as a flex.
Just sitting there in the corner, cross-legged, smoking. So he moves out, finds a hotel, blah, blah, blah. Spends a bit of time looking around restaurants and supermarkets, finding hummus. This particular bit as well, when he's just kind of boating around trying to avoid yuzu in Paris, he really likes his food, or Welbeck does. He really knows what he's talking about, you know? Spends a good kind of half page here and there going through the menu for us. Did you get that as well?
Yeah, he's sort of, like, I can see him intentionally turning it up. Like, over time, he starts off just giving detailed descriptions of food, but whenever he can, he'll actually describe everyone's order at a cafe or a restaurant.
Mm.
And it gets bigger and bigger until towards the end, it reaches the point where, towards the end of the book, where food is basically the closest thing he has to pleasure.
Yeah.
The plot point about him getting old and fat. It's like the food taking over the book, and the good food is all he has.
Yeah, just like watching cookery programs and stuff. But yeah,
TV too. TV is also recurring. It's like he's got that addiction to TV, and he's got that bit of hyper reality going on.
Mm.
Later on, when serious events transpire, he doesn't believe them until he saw what he saw once again on the screen.
Yeah, that's a good point. So yeah, he boats around, finds a bit of a restaurant, feeds himself. Unbelievable amount of time is devoted to hummus. And I thought there was a bit of trauma, I don't know, evident. He starts to kind of look after himself a bit better after he moves out. He kind of seems to have been really rattled, as he would be, by going through Yuzu's email history. But at the same time, taking the Captorix, he's not really doing himself any favors because he's totally impotent. So, yeah, no rebounds for Florent.
Also,
not even the chestnut-haired girl in El Akia.
Love it.
Yeah, I love the way he framed it too, that he was going to do that thing where people disappear.
Mm. Like,
watching a thing about it. That was actually an interesting plot point that got compressed into a short bit, but actually tells a lot.
Mm.
For one thing, he decided he'd run away from his life and do the missing persons thing, but his life was just the girlfriend he didn't care about and his job, which he wasn't really at the time.
Mm.
So his running away was simply changing houses. That was it.
Yeah. To just flag his job briefly. So he started out his career like he did pretty well. He went to an agricultural college. That's a point that comes up a bit in the book. And he worked through what is, I guess, supposed like their kind of equivalent of a public service job for a big bureaucracy, and eventually got headhunted from the agricultural institute to work for, you know, the board or blah, blah, in a pretty high level position, trying to hawk French cheeses to other markets to try and sort of shore up their industry that's being collapsed from underneath by importing cheap product into the dairy industry. So it's something that he's aware of the whole time and just gets paid too well and kind of golden handcuffs, doesn't really give a shit about it, but knows exactly what he's doing because he went to agricultural college and he grew up in an area with a bunch of farmers and things around him. So he's got that amazing cogdis that's at the heart, I think, of maybe a lot of people who work in these kind of jobs. So I think that characterizes his mindset through the book. Would you maybe agree with that, Sheepdog? Or?
Yeah, well, so he's from Normandy, and so basically like the friend he has who he met at college, who's one of his only friends, he sort of sees that, you know, he used to be sort of the happy-go-lucky, like had vinyl, smoked weed, was just studying at uni, and now he's gone back to his farm, and he's just still got his vinyl, still wearing his, like, you know, flannel shirt, still smoking weed, but nothing's really working for him anymore.
Mm.
And he sees, like, the, you know, the home of where he's come from, and was quite nostalgic about it, of what has actually happened due to these sort of, you know, European Union globalist economic policies. So
from this part, Florent waxes a little bit lyrical. I'm going to bugger up the pronunciation the whole way through. It's Florent, Florent. So he goes in and he kind of...
Because he hates his name.
Claude, yeah, we should call him Claude. Goes through and starts talking about kind of past loves and thinking, where did it all go wrong? How did I end up with somebody who sleeps with dogs? So he looks into... So a previous girlfriend partner that he had, Kate. I think he went to Brazil on holiday or something and he slept with somebody else. Is that what happened there?
I'm trying to remember, yeah.
So he buggered that up.
The thing with Kate, they made a point that he was actually having a true human connection with her. And this was one of his only cases of love with another person. They even had a very, over-the-top, ham-fisted bit where a seemingly omnipotent German waiter has nothing to say to him except, don't let her go, stay with her.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
That was probably one of the more important parts of the book.
Yeah.
And he completely fails at it. He just loses contact with her until she goes somewhere else, and then he forgets about her for some random brown Brazilian girl shipped over.
Yes.
It's a recurring thing. He keeps losing these loves in his life. It happens in other relationships too, because he can't turn down a brown girl for a quick Tinder hookup.
Yeah, yeah. And then so it goes through the Kate, like the big sort of, you know, flowering, not adolescent, but like young adult, early 20s romance, blah, blah. And then starts talking about Claire. So Claire, he was with while he had a job. Sorry, I didn't bring this up before. He worked for Monsanto. We didn't get you invited to too many dinner parties. And Claire was a big liberal amateur dramatist kind of actor type at the time, trying to get around to a bunch of auditions and stuff. So he sort of talks about their relationship and that tension that they had a bit, but they still kind of had a pretty good thing going. And he mentioned this amazing acronym that I hadn't heard before. Bobos. Do you remember that, Demok?
Bourgeois bohemian.
Yeah.
I reckon something that French would throw around like hipster or something. It was probably really...
Yeah. He's such a baboo. So he and Claire live in this apartment that they inherit. Well, Claire inherits from her mum who dies in a car crash, but was pretty terrible to Claire anyway. I don't know. They go into it a bit in the book. So Claire ends up with this kind of plum apartment in Paris. You know, it's 3-bedroom, amazing courtyard, rah-rah-rah. It's probably worth the GDP of Uganda. And the whole time she's sort of going through these Amdram auditions and that kind of shit at the same time that Claude is working for Monsanto and, you know, fucking up all their social relationships, making sure that their Bobo neighbors will never come around and, you know, give them a cup of sugar. Did you have any other takeaways from that part, Sheepdog?
No, not really. I remember going through it. I just remember that Kate's entire acting... Claire. Ends up going nowhere essentially, and that he does reconnect with her later on in life, and just sort of sees that she's no longer as attractive, and she's quite heavier, and it's like, well, that's her life over then, pretty much, because like she doesn't have any skills.
Didn't
think so.
I think you've lighted upon this too. We should probably get into it a bit while we're here. So we've talked about Welbeck writing about women. So Yuzu and Claire and Kate and that sort of stuff. It's important, I suppose, at this point to say that Welbeck's got a really, the nicest way to put it would probably be saying primal view of women.
He's a horny friend.
Talking about, absolutely. Yeah, really. Like dialed up to 11, talks about, you know, pussies and blowjobs and describes Yuzu as, you know, best characteristics being all three holes and all sorts of shit like that. So he's really, you know, he's not an old romantic. So talking about Kate as well, and in the bit that you're talking about when they catch up later on in the book, and he sort of notes that they have this almost like failed, you know, hookup, but he can't get it up at all anymore and he doesn't want to anyway because she's got, quote, you know, rolls of fat, end quote. The whole thing is kind of, it's pretty grisly. The way that he talks, I found it fairly uncomfortable reading a lot of those parts, I guess, just because it was sort of, I don't know, maybe it's designed to do that. Maybe it's designed to kind of challenge you, like you're still reading through this, so you're kind of complicit in these reductive understandings. I don't know. What did you take away, Mick? Oh, not Mick, sorry. Maybe DeMarco.
Yeah, a few things. First of all, Terry from the Terry cast, shout out, got it 100% right. I just get my mum to read the books to me, so she hated these parts. But I needed the pronunciation and French accent correct, so I made her do all the sex scenes. Just going, no, again, Frencher. It needs to look up the pronunciation to get this just right. But, yeah, he is. Shout out to Terry.
It's an amazing segue.
Wow.
What I noticed interesting here, apart from his over-the-top sex descriptions and uncomfortable sex scenes, was that his one thing I noticed was that her life also took a negative turn because of international trade.
Yes.
Because of international flight, but it also makes a point that she was a sort of a culture actor. She was doing French culture bits.
Mm.
Very old, very old-fashioned Nordic tall, thin look originally.
Yeah.
She got fat and old. That she couldn't get into the big domestic, or not domestic, the big
international
commercial movie market because being tall, blonde, and Nordic was out of fashion, and they wanted little Latina girls and other exotic, not her, so she just couldn't get in. Even though she had massive chops as an actor and was actually skilled and took home all sorts of awards, she just couldn't get out of the small French market. Eventually there too. So a lot of these little asides about these girls' lives, and just even in his little weird anecdotes at the start of chapters, it all ties into that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember that bit now that you bring it up. Yeah, because it's kind of tragic what happens to her down the track as well when they catch back up. You know, she's virtually exactly where he left her, except now not really getting any auditions and just waiting for her property to appreciate enough to make it worth selling.
And also, it does parallel himself in the end too, in that she just got fat and alcoholic and stopped caring.
Yeah, I suppose it's sort of interesting to note, you know, they're both kind of two sides of the same coin, really, when they meet again, but he's, you know, unbelievably judgmental of her. I suppose they haven't... they wouldn't be viewed in the same way. It's probably the nicest way to put it.
She seems quite keen on him to sort of reignite the relationship, but he just can't. He doesn't care. Like, he just leaves and that's it. He was just,
Yeah, he just blows her off over brunch. Very kind of French moment. Just being like, oh, I've got an appointment with my psychotherapist. I'll see you later. And never does. Yeah, how romantic. So it's at this part that he's talking about while he's got this job at Monsanto and all the rest of it, he understands what they're doing to kind of agriculture and organic farming and all the rest of it. So Normandy being one of these regions that's famous for having these amazing cheese, blah, blah. And now, kind of don't have two coins to rub together, and he's instrumental in it. He understands. There's a quote from this part where he says, "The more I try and do the right thing, the harder it is to make ends meet." I felt that kind of hit the nail on the head a little bit, and a lot of people might be able to relate, I don't know, depending on what gig you're in. So this is when he, I guess, decides he's had enough of Paris and buggers off back to Normandy to catch up with old mate Emmerich that he went through agricultural college with. So this is the aging flannel-wearing pot smoker that we've been talking about before. So he found out that Emmerich's still living on the same farm, so his ancestral estate, but he's been selling off, you know, bit by bit just to kind of pay the bills and keep himself going. So to the highest bidder, really, and China. Makes note in the book. Yeah. Makes note in the book of the fact that, you know, the highest bidders are never domestic, shall we say? Yeah. It's always, you know, the local farmers and the rest of it, even if they would have liked the land, they can't possibly compete. And Emmerich himself acknowledges that he's selling it to the people who can pay him the highest price, and he knows that he's, you know, doing other people in out of the land.
Yeah, good thing it's not happening here.
Oh yeah, no, it is a really good thing that we're not.
We're not doing the same thing. Yeah,
Okay. Sure,
no, not at all. No, not even with baby formula.
It's like you're being complicit in looting a failing system at that point if you understand that you are selling off, you know, infrastructure that could be vital to future generations, to foreign interested parties, per se. It's kind of like these people already are saying, like, fuck this gay earth, I'm just going to, you know, sell everything that I've got and call it a day. This is the boomer mindset, really, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, well, I...
Sorry, boomers.
Yeah, that's all. Well, all one of them left. Hi, Costa. So, So he's staying with this sort of, you know, aging college mate, putting all of the failings of the estate and the rest of it down to the milk quotas in Brussels. And this is when he gets to thinking about, I guess, the last great love and where he might have a chance to rekindle his life and the rest of it, which is Camille, the genius med slash veterinary student that goes on to characterize quite a lot of the back half of the book. But now I think it's probably a good chance for us to chuck in our musical interlude. What do you reckon?
Sounds good.
So when we come back, we'll have a chat about our musical interlude in accordance with the fair use policy, and then keep going right through to the end of Serotonin. So what we're going to play, do you remember what it was, Sheepdog? What are we checking
out? Here's to You by Joe and Baez. I think that's how you say it.
I've heard Baez. Doesn't matter.
Now the song itself...
I love this song.
Apparently it was in a film in 1971. Now that so what it's about is the execution of two anarchists in 1920s United States. The two blokes got done, for burglary or robbery, but it was seen as, because of their political opinions, that was the reason that the execution was going place, because there wasn't, they didn't feel like, or the public didn't feel like there was sufficient evidence to convict them to death on something that was still up in the air. So even though it's anarchist, I just think it's nifty that it's still, you know, just political dissidence. And it's Here's to You,
Nicole,
that because of the sort of public nature of their execution, that their sort of ideals were able to spread more than they ever would if they were just, you know, doing what they were doing and talking about anarchism on the street corner.
Yeah. They were able to spread their views to 9.5 million viewers on YouTube.
Yeah. I think it's later on relates heavily to this Amerik fella's character arc here. We'll get that a bit later, but it's very, very relevant to his actions.
Yeah. All right, so we'll drop it in for everybody to make their own minds up. We'll have a bit of a chat after, but here's to you, Joan Baez.
know how you were telling you that you were talking about how they were bored and they killed themselves on the Spanish highway.
Yeah.
You know, Nauru, when it was like a tax haven and it had like the greatest income capita per person per, or in a planet, basically. That's the only thing that they did back then is they just drank beer and drove around the circular road and killed themselves on the road. Pretty funny.
Jesus.
There was 12,000 Nauruans, I guess you can call them.
Holy moly.
And there's not too much you can do with the money that they made from all the phosphate mining they got from all the bird shit.
I've heard about this, yeah.
Yeah, most of it was held in the trust funds and investments across the world. They had like heaps of real estate in Melbourne. They had like a fucking West End musical band. They just did a whole bunch of weird shit. They relied heaps on imported food and had like they developed a taste for Western cuisine, you know, your McDonald's and your Kentucky Fried Nuggies and all that sort of thing.
Succulent Chinese meals, yeah.
Yeah, and because of that, they had like a 50% diabetes rate. Everyone was a fat bastard and like the male life expectancy was 55 and they were really bored. So all they did was they bought these really expensive boomer bills that they imported from America. And they drove them around the circular road while pissed out of their brains and just killed them.
Fuck yeah.
That really sounds like a passage from this book, like something he might have just dropped in if it was on his mind.
No, you did bring up like the Spanish people killing themselves because the roads are boring, and that's like the thing that's to mind. I just couldn't remember anything about it, and then I had to do a little bit of digging to find that shit. But it's
we're definitely keeping that in the show. That's good content. Yeah, yeah. See, don't say we don't teach you anything, listeners.
I had a bit of a Welbeck moment last night when I was out, and there were these two girls, and they were talking about like what they did for work, and she says sensual massage, and I said, "Oh yeah, so what do you do?" And she's like, "Oh, you know, rub people down and stuff like that," and then I finish them off. Yeah, and so basically, what she gives wristies for a living. It's just like, that's not a fucking job, but...
It's the thought economy right there.
Yeah, I know. Mind you, if someone's going to pay me $50 to finger a bird, I'd probably do it.
That will never happen in the inverse, my friend. It's always a bit...
Yeah, I know, but just imagine.
Rubbing tugs.
Just imagine how the woman paying you $50 to touch her...
Would look, yeah. Fuck. I remember... When I was 18, we were doing scav hunt, and we went to, like, this trucker. One of the scav hunts was a real prostitute. I'm like, I'll do it if you pay for it. Get in there.
Still recording, just FYI. Go off, no worries.
Birds have come out. Well, they're not birds. They're fucking warthogs. And I'm just like, mate, like, you would have to pay me so much to go through with it. There's no way we're paying for this. And just fucking walked out. Like, I just couldn't. Yeah. Anyway.
That was a proper Welbeck moment.
Yeah.
You just need to have mentioned you were chain smoking the entire time, and you couldn't
just
get
chain smoking with vape. Like, oh, I'm disgusted.
your cherry jewel. Oh. Well, yeah. So, how about the song? Not a lot of lyrics.
Yeah, no, it's just that on repeat. But I really like it. So,
Yeah, it is good. And from the composition, it's from a film about those two.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even remember it.
It's also
the film Sacco Saco and Vizenti.
There we go. Sacco and Vizenti. I think it's like another 70s flick, so it's kind of in line with it all, and composed by Ennio Morricone of the Good, the Bad, the Ugly fame. Probably butchered that pronunciation too, but it's my show, Sumi. Pardon?
Is it Giuliano?
Ennio, the composer.
Yeah, I don't know how to... I think I'm doing the director. Oh, yeah, anyway. Sorry.
No, you're Italian.
I'm not even going to try.
I'd be much better off if these people just spoke American, for Christ's sake.
Also, for younger listeners in the audience, such as myself, it's also known for being that song from Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah. I didn't play Metal Gear, so...
Hideo Kojima games are fucking... I don't understand it. People love them, but I just can't get into it, man. How's my head?
Tricky. There's your Zoomer content from the month. So
11 hours of cinematics. Fuck that.
It's Kino.
So the the song then, fair use policy. The review. I thought it was really trying to drive in the point home, but there wasn't a lot of talk about what the case was actually about or whatever. It wasn't quite a folk song. It was more sort of an anthem. I imagine she supports what they did. You know,
weird if she didn't.
Giving him a cheers the whole song. Yeah, it would be weird if she didn't. She wrote the song about it. It wasn't
like,
just called
imagine
it.
If Rage Against the Machine was actually just, you know, like fascist the whole time. That would be weird.
Very, very undercover, yeah. Yeah, I don't know, Joan Baez. I don't know too much about her either. Folk singer, I imagine.
Rage Against the Machine, but a futurist version where it's Rage as a machine.
So
Rage
Joan,
of the Machine.
Joan Baez, or however you say it, is an American singer, songwriter, musician, and activist. So,
hey, there we go.
There you go.
Right.
Her contemporary folk music often includes songs of protest or social justice.
Bingo banger. Mm-hmm. So Italian anarchists that I think they were implicated in a couple of robberies and then they kind of shot a bloke but maybe didn't. But then they got killed anyway at the end.
Oh, well.
There you go. So I don't know. I've procured the film. I'm probably going to watch it because you may be interested in the story, but thanks for the recommendation, Sheepdog. That was... It's a good
no
track. Rackets.
Yeah.
A little bit of historicity in there. Mm. So we're going to dive back into old Matt Ferrant's terrible month. What was happening when we left him? It was Camille, wasn't it?
Yeah, at this stage, after his first visit to Amerik, he goes back to try and meet Camille. He also talks about how trying to meet all these people is something someone would try to do before they die, and that he's effectively, at this stage, he feels that he's trying to do like a one last dying ritual of meeting all the people that affected his life.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
He does narrow it down to say that, oh, it's just a funeral for my penis because it's dead from lyrics. And I'm just meeting...
It literally is.
But it's not, because he met Amerik as well, which I think implies that really it's him as a whole, because it was just these women and Amerik were the people in his life.
Mm. So he...
So it's like he's downplaying his death ritual about his actual death to convince himself it's just about his dick not working. Whereas you can see at this stage he's already... A lot of the things where it implies that he's only just started planning something, you see the seeds of it much earlier in this book.
Mm. Yeah, I found the same kind of thing. He talks a little bit about how when he and Camille first met, she's kind of idealistic and very intelligent uni type. She's studying veterinary medicine, I think. And that all kind of goes south, her first trip to a factory farm. So she goes to this poultry factory farm and sees what it's about, and then kind of gives it in. And Florent knows at the time that, well, she doesn't give it in. She goes through with it, but Florent knows at the time because of his work with the agricultural board that that's not even a bad farm that she went to. so he kind of, yeah, flags the horrors of factory farming and the rest of it, which I'm sure most of us are aware of, that industrial agriculture can be pretty horrible, especially for animals. And talks about that in the context of, you know, it having been accelerated by the sort of EU machinations.
I think it's worth putting forward here too, that as well as being a pretty heavy-handed metaphor for the free market, how because they want the cheaper chickens, they'll just grow them into retarded mutants and throw all the male ones in a grinder. That's obvious and heavy-handed, but then it goes further that he's just sort of accepting of it, and she's freaked out and crying because she's got a bit of traditionalism and a bit of justice in her.
Mm.
Whereas he's just like, you know what, you can't fight the big businesses, I'll just reassure her and turn her around and stick the blindfold on her.
Yeah.
It sort of ties into how his ineffectual as a bureaucrat in his job and that he doesn't deliver there either because he's just sort of getting pushed around by the market forces and the politics and the policies.
Hmm. Yeah, it kind of ties a pretty nice bow on it. That's a really good summary. these takes, and it's not, that's not the only kind of really uncomfortable bits of this. While he's staying with Emmerich, who lives in this sort of, you know, rural estate, decrepit and kind of not quite falling down around him, but being sold out from underneath him, or he's selling out from underneath him, he takes up some pretty odd hobbies. So he gets into shooting with old mate Emmerich and buys himself a pretty good pair of binoculars and starts to sort of see what he can see around the area. So looking partially for Camille, but what he ends up finding in the first instance is a German bird watcher. So this whole sequence made me, yeah, deeply uncomfortable. But here we go, because it's Welbeck. We've got to go through it, I suppose.
I think so, it's also worth mentioning that he has three visits with Emmerich, counting meeting him in uni. And he does have a character arc. In uni, he's young and idealistic and smoking weed, listening to Deep Purple. On the second meeting, which we discussed last time, he is poor and he's losing money constantly. He's inherited his father's estate and he could just sit back.
His wife and kids are no longer living with him either.
He has a wife and kids in the second time he visits him and is apparently not smoking weed at that stage. Living a hard life and they're all working hard. Then he comes back the third time and his life is a complete mess. His house is falling apart and hasn't been cleaned in years. The wife and kids are gone. He is smoking weed and drinking until he can't make eye contact with people. He doesn't heat that. He just wears a jacket all day. And he's attempting to rent bungalows on the edge of his property near the sea, but failing.
And yeah.
He's just gone completely downhill.
Yeah, that's right. The bungalow is where he kind of ends up getting into this curly situation with the German. But that's a really good sort of insight from you there about Emmerich's character arc. I hadn't necessarily put it that neatly for myself. I thought that Emmerich, in the book anyway, served as a bit of an allegory for the sort of rural archetype. You know, it's the story that's familiar, I suppose, to a lot of people in rural areas the world over, particularly if they're subject to these same kind of bureaucracies. And we flagged it a little bit before, but yeah, I think Emmerich was meant to be representative of the same sort of growth and decline of these things. So going from being the sort of focus on, you know, the land that you've inherited and the family, and then going back into the same sort of, yeah, same habits and negative stuff of youth, because what else really is there for Emmerich in the end? You know, he realizes that all the dice are loaded. Is it sort of even worth playing? Did you get the same thing from that, Sheepdog?
Yeah. I can't really add much to that, but it's, I don't know, it kind of reminded me, like how Emmerich conducted himself is like, sort of how I was like, you know, even just a few years ago.
I think with Emmerich, it's actually worth just pulling his part of it outside of the book, then coming back to the rest later, because he's got his own contained story there. And it's split up between several sequences where it'll jump to him, then to the German. I've split up that with Camille before, but it might just be worth looking at his thing as a whole, even if it does mean skipping forward.
Yeah.
So from this point, his... after the run-in with the German, which I don't mean to drop, but might just be worth getting to the end of Emmerich's arc first.
I mean, we can go through the German thing super quickly. Basically, it's just Florent notices something strange about this one sort of place with the German bird watcher in it. There's a young girl who comes and goes every day, and he gets it into his head that there might be something funny going on there, you know, so he obviously can't help but look. And as readers, Welbeck doesn't spare us in having to look as well. So it's almost like a little bit of a digression from the main story, but it adds color to the whole thing. And he, you know, using his very fancy binoculars that he's picked up at the same time as Emmerich's going through his arc and teaching him how to shoot and the rest of it, he keeps an eye on the place for a while and eventually breaks himself in and decides that he's going to find out what's going on, and finds out that the German bird watcher is actually a pedophile, and then is confronted in quite a sort of just an awkward, weird scene where the German bird watcher comes back before Florent expects, and then they have a almost like absurdist interaction, And obviously the German bird watcher buggers off. That's the end of that. And Florent moves on as well. Did I kind of sum that up okay, Demont?
Yeah, I think it's also also quite important because this was, it did feel a bit like a quick thing he dropped in for a bit of shock value. It doesn't tie in as much as a lot of the other segments. But of note was the fact that Florent was really, really indifferent and disconnected to the situation. It was like he watched out of interest. He saw the films of what happened in that house.
Yes.
And the first criticism he had was that the filmography was poor and he did a really shit shot. It was a bad
job. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
It was like he was just disconnected from everything that was wrong with that scene, for real.
Yeah.
Then when the guy comes in, his first worry was for his own life, in that the German might attack him. It doesn't occur to him until afterwards that he could fight back or he could tell anyone. He just sort of goes, oh, he's probably run off to, like, Philippines or Poland or somewhere with no extradition treaty.
Yes.
It's not my problem. They just
leave. Just like, the utter cowardice and moral turpitude that he demonstrates in that whole sequence is just really like Florent, utterly spineless
in this certain, interaction. In a certain totally way, you can sort of connect that to sort of like the grooming gangs that happens in Europe, or I think what most of us understand in the UK, and then maybe even loosely like the Jeffrey Epstein thing, how like mainstream media, who should have, you know, probably ran with this a little bit more, have sort of just moved on with the media cycle as soon as he died. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that those are all really good points. Yeah. I think the same after effects of the worst excesses and effects of this sort of globalization and bureaucratic grinding down in the cities of, you know, man and morality and any kind of focus upon children and family and the rest of it, which has had the same effects, like you're saying, the sort of grooming gangs and things and the tragedies in England and other places, and evidenced by lack of Epstein coverage or any meaningful engagement with the fact that he definitely didn't kill himself.
Well, it's all been individual citizens just going on news and fucking surprising him by saying Epstein didn't kill himself. It hasn't been the journalists themselves.
Yeah, I only heard today in a news report where they were saying, you know, because, you know, Prince Andrew has made his first comment since old mate didn't kill himself. And in that news bulletin, they were saying, oh, you know, and Epstein, who committed suicide, blah, blah, blah. So this sort of, it's already been memory holed. It's already been kind of duck shoved under the carpet. Like, we're just not going to address that anymore. You know, we've moved on. And it's the same with Florent in this bit where he sort of, yeah, in the book, it is kind of stark that this whole, you're right, Demok, the whole thing happens and it's just disgusting. And I'm kind of reading this one-eyed, just thinking, what is this? And he just moves on. And what he is concerned about, yeah, is just self-preservation and thinking, oh, this is actually really a full-on experience, you know? He's kind of outside of himself, whereas anybody with any kind of genuine character or fight in them would be, you know, the first to collar this guy.
Well, I think the book is about the emasculated man, and the character, the emasculated man himself, is a metaphor for French society or European society or Western society as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. So that bit happens around the same time that Aymeric is teaching, or kind of being pissed and around while Florent is learning how to shoot, which brings us, I suppose, through to the next part. Kind of goes through a bit of a farmer's meeting, a bit of a kind of couple of toolbox talks and that sort of stuff. Do you remember those parts, Demont?
Yeah, I do remember that. He just sort of tags along, and it's sort of evident that he's there for Aymeric because he's like his last friend, but he's not really involved. It's sort of like he's just floating there while everything happens. Aymeric's arc, he's just sort of an observer.
Yeah, and also he notes as well that because of his history with, you know, Monsanto and the Agricultural Board and the very companies that are selling these lands out, and the farmers and the meetings that he's going to are about what these communities are going to do in the wake of the milk price hikes, which echoes the Yellow Vest movement with the diesel tax hikes. And the farming communities are all talking about what they're going to do and how they're going to kind of survive and continue to go on to a backdrop of many of their friends killing themselves. The whole thing is incredibly grim and a corollary for a lot of stuff going on in regional areas around the world. Well, definitely the sort of Western world and places that we flagged. And Florent realizes, I think, rightly, that he's not welcome there. Like, he's not one of them, and they all can smell him a mile away. And he just sort of leaves. And it's, yeah, it's a kind of one of the more sort of telling and tragic parts of the whole book. I think Welbeck actually maybe was a bit ahead of himself. You know, he was kind of having a moment of purity, shall we say. Yeah, so
the whole time he's aware after it builds up a lot in that Amarik is cleaning his gun a lot.
Mm.
And he keeps seeing him doing that. He asks about shooting lessons. But he's realizing at this point that this is eventually going to become an armed conflict because no one's going to back down.
Yeah.
And he tries to convince himself it won't happen, and he tries to talk Amarik out of it. He said, your life's fallen apart, but you could maybe get a Moldovan wife or a Thai wife and just retire on your family's inherited income, and it'll be all good.
And yeah.
I think there's a direct parallel drawn between Amarik and Florent. Florent is completely ruthless, and he does have his inheritance, but essentially, his parents just killed themselves and left him alone in the world. He's not got any family. He lives in a Telga hotel. He's like the ideal image of a boomer bug man who just lives on antidepressants and cigarettes and
hummus.
Doesn't know anyone. Yeah, he lives on hummus and antidepressants. That's not quite true. He stuffs his face with quite a lot of fancy food, actually.
But yeah, whelks and white wine sauce or some shit. I don't know. There's a lot of it in the book.
Yeah, he has a taste for seafood. I've noticed a lot of his girlfriends eat manlier than he does. But
yeah.
There's going to be seafood lovers fighting me about this on Twitter now because I'm implying that steak is cooler, but it is. Anyway, as opposed to Amarik, who also inherited land and money, and he took the same uni education, he could have become a rich bureaucrat like Florent did.
Mm.
But he essentially went with the full Twitter meme and he did return to tradition. He chose to become a farmer and he decided to stay working the land despite the fact
that it
cost him and his family.
Mm.
He had that sense of pride and he'd lose money even to deliver higher quality even though it wasn't.
Mm.
It's like he was the idealist who really wants to become a farmer and does, but suffers for it.
Mm.
And I'd say that ultimately, when it comes to the fact that there is, if we're stepping forward here, I'll just say that there is an armed conflict.
We're at that point.
It's called the Boogaloo.
The Boogaloo.
Milk Boogaloo.
I'm tripping over my own tongue here a lot, but he does return to his family's ancient warrior heritage when it comes to going Ruby Ridge with the French police over a truck of milk.
Yeah. Yeah, literally, they've been stopping trucks of milk. The note that I have for this part was milk war protectionism, so they're stopping trucks of cheap milk from coming in. They're literally kind of holding them up in the highway, and then there's a whole bunch of negotiation that needs to happen to get them, you know,
I guess you could say them
through or whatever.
The milk truck didn't arrive.
This is epic symbolism. For once in his life, he wasn't happy to see milk truck arrive.
He's talking about three different milk trucks for the entirety of the book, which he's had past relations with.
The book milk trucks.
Florent, in this bit, there was quite an insightful bit where he talks about his, you know, when he was at the agricultural department or when he was doing that, you know, trying to hawk Normandy cheese and all the rest of it internationally. He talked about conversations that went on behind the scenes and he conveys them through Florent's perspective where they're sort of saying that the social plan actually has this baked into it. They want to displace these agricultural people, you know, the people who have that connection to the land. They want to displace the agricultural sector. They know to within, you know, two significant figures how many people they're going to leave behind as actual farmers within France, and then the rest of it they're just going to ship in. that bit, I suppose, particularly sort of confronting if anybody still had any delusions about free trade agreements being, you know, good for most people involved, or definitely people on the bottom of the totem pole.
Wrong.
Yeah. So, milk wars, milk truck doesn't arrive, and Aymeric has been spending an awful lot of time, you know, cleaning his gun and wearing weird masks and spending a lot of time on Twitter. So he jumps out. Yeah, jumps out into the roadway, and yeah, do you want to go through the big moment, Democ?
He gives himself a very, attempted to say very Mishima, but I haven't read Mishima, so I'm probably wrong about this, but
well, gives himself a warrior's test.
Yeah, he sets fire to one of the milk trucks from memory, well. He, you know, sets a massive fire to one of the milk trucks, blows that, and then in a shootout with the police decides to kill himself. Is that right?
Well, he instigates the shootout by shooting himself.
Oh, that's it. And the rest of the... And
everyone else starts firing at one another.
The rest of the farmers think he's killed by the cops. Is that right?
Because no one sees it. No one sees it except Florent, because he's watching with his binoculars.
Yeah, that's it.
Florent's and one journalist who... had it on the news pretty much immediately that one of them shot themselves and that broke it down into a gunfight.
Mm.
And what was interesting was after it gets to the gunfight, it just cuts away. Like that was, like I'd say that would actually be the climax of it, especially for the climax and conclusion for Almeric, who I'd say is almost a second protagonist here.
Yes.
And then it cuts to the next day with Florent and his... He doesn't believe it happened until he turns on the television and sees it again.
Mm.
It was like he was just indifferent and floating nearby once again while all these things happened.
Yeah.
Well, you see Aymeric as sort of a metaphor for regional France, basically. And it wasn't necessarily killed. Like, it was driven to the point of suicide, of desperation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's... Absolutely, and you know it is really written in an incredibly sort of tragic and kind of moving way. One of the criticisms that I've read about this book is that it doesn't follow that, and that kind of isn't the conclusion, you know, because that really is not only true to life and important. It feels like the way to go, because what kind of happens from here is really just diving back into Florent's inner struggles and monologue and what happens with him. So after that, he obviously skips town because he was known that, you know, he has some sort of brief interaction with the police that are going through Aymeric's place and finding his, you know, collection of Boogaloo supplies. With the exception of the gun and another gun, I think he ends up with two that he was training with Aymeric with. And I think Florent skips town with those in the back of the G-Class Mercedes and decides to go and find Camille for one last time. Know, sort of make it go something for his worthless life. So he's I'm sure you'll remember when I say it, he's talking about his gun, the Steyr-Mannlicher, and his binoculars.
Yes.
So he spends a huge amount of time talking about his capacity to shoot with this gun and that sort of stuff. So he finds out where Camille lives and ends up there and keeping an eye on her. So what happens from here, Democ, do you remember?
Yeah, after he skips town and spends a while by himself in the woods with no Wi-Fi, I keep repeating the point that there's no Wi-Fi here and he's just alone with his thoughts for a long time.
Ted Kaczynski. Yeah.
He goes Ted Kaczynski mode.
Mm.
And then his afterwards, he sort of, everything reminds him of Camille.
Mm.
Constantly, everything, like the shape of the house, the way something... specific foods and places, he just keeps remembering Camille and it just debilitates him because it just brings on his depression of losing her.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think is worth mentioning because he cheated on her with a black girl is why.
Mm.
He couldn't turn down that ghetto booty.
Well, you burn the coal and you pay that toll.
So here he is, like 30 years later, 20 years later, still paying the toll, and he goes to a place of work, which he found online, and starts stalking her.
Mm.
He stalks her at work and in her own home for days. And eventually decides or convinces himself that he could enter her life again and have her love back, but not while she's got her son. And she's a single mother, by the way, because that just happens, is how he puts it. But he's sitting across the road in an abandoned restaurant he'd broken into and had been stalking the kid and the nanny for days, and he convinces himself that if he killed the kid now, the police would never catch him and he could come back in 6 months and she'd fall for him again. That's the story of himself.
Yeah, that's some absurd shit.
So he gets really close and has a shot on the kid, and right as he's telling himself about how it will all be good, he just can't do it.
Yeah.
Calling back to earlier when he was training, he had trouble shooting live birds because he couldn't bring himself to do that either.
Hmm.
In that he's clearly a completely immoral person, but he's not a killer.
Yeah, he's a total coward. You know, even when it's something that he wants and all the rest of it.
Also, I think this bit, it feels like a pretty strong metaphor for boomers going, yeah, we'll just kill the next generation. It'll make me happy. Like a really dark, ham-fisted way of putting that, basically. It's not subtle.
Yeah. But he can't. Although
having children just to buy a new Mustang.
I'll shoot her kid and then I can get a Mustang with her.
Slow Mustang with a 5-liter VR. Yeah.
We're only in our late 40s. We'll just get a dog afterwards.
But he can't pull it off. And then he decides to return to Paris. And that makes a fair bit of hay talking about the trains. So one of the points he makes is that, you know, the collapse for him, Paris and cities and France and everything broadly has been charted at the same time as the train services have all gone to shit. Quite literally in the case of the restrooms, which, if they're not locked, he says, are in quite a state. He talks about this sort of public transport thing. I'm sure most of us, if we've been unfortunate enough to be exposed to it, it could relate in some ways.
Crazy how infrastructure do that, you know?
Shout out to Melbourne Metro.
Shout out to Sydney Metro.
So he's saying that, you know, human communities had things built up and had it together and went from hamlets to cities. Then there's a quote from it, and that invention of the city, loneliness. Only the couple could offer an alternative. And then, quote, we will never return to that tribal stage, end quote. So Florence Dunne, I guess, sort of accept the terminal nature of his circumstances and the country broadly, saying that, you know, he's not going to be in a couple. He's not going to have any alternative to the loneliness and decrepitude of the city. They'll never return to the life in the hamlet and the family and all the rest of it.
That was also pretty evident in his early part about his parents, how because they were going to lose each other, they decided to kill themselves together because each other was all they had. Even though their entire life was each other, they had no one else. The same way that Amaric's life completely falls apart when his wife dies because it seems he doesn't have anyone else either. Like in the societies, which they don't live in, by the way, the people in these, as he accuses the Dutch, they don't live in a society, they just live in an economy.
They're all cogs in the machine, eh?
Yeah, and their social interaction is basically limited to your wife, which is, you know, one woman who, if you're a good modern bug man like Florent is, you'll lose from burning the coal in like a year anyway.
No manabuns or anything of that. No book clubs.
No, yeah, I was going to say, to get a bit meta. Yeah, if only I had a book club. So it's when he gets back to Paris and he decides, you know, he's going to basically crawl into a hole and die. But not before consulting with his doctor, which is the strangely one of the most sort of nurturing and base characters in the whole book. a doctor who smokes camels habitually and talks about offering prescriptions for certain trips to Thailand. But he brings him in for some blood work and, you know, up his prescriptions of Captorix. And some of the blood work results come back, and he's fascinated to find that Floran is basically swimming in cortisol, so swimming in the sort of stress neurotransmitter. You know, it's never a good sign when the doctor says that's really strange. So it's at this point that Floran, I suppose, throws his hands up and says, well, that's that, and finds himself a little studio apartment and decides he's going to read all the books and all the rest of it that he hasn't made the time for in the rest of his life. There's a part here when he, I don't know, did you have anything from what I've just flagged there, Sheepdog or Demon?
Sorry, what was that?
Oh, did you have anything from him sort of coming back and, you know, getting the diagnosis from his doctor and all that stuff?
No, not really.
Right. Demon, did you have anything?
What I found interesting was that at this stage, this was the part where I got the transactional relationships taken, because it seemed like he was hinting that strongly.
Mm.
And that was right where the doctor suddenly treats him like another person, and on his way out of the hotel, the hotel clerk there seems to fall through a bit.
Yeah.
Maybe he would have had a chance with her, maybe he could have made friends with the doctor, but he chooses not to and he pushes them away.
Yeah, yeah.
So sort of like he's addicted to this lifestyle, even though he knows it's killing him with sadness.
Mm.
The words of his doctor nearly literally.
Mm.
But at this point, he chooses to go to this place where he completely isolates himself even further by living off of Uber Eats.
Yes.
And
yep.
Using a rubbish chute so he doesn't even have to take out the rubbish and see people.
Mm.
He just sits down and smokes and eats food all day while talking about how society has an oral fixation.
Mm.
Which is interesting. It's, you know, smoking and eating all day and going, oh, these kids these days, they're nothing but oral fixation. There's no sex on TV anymore. He just lives on cooking shows. And all he does is eat and get fatter and fatter, sort of like you're a classic foodie boomer.
And he also decides that he's going to set himself up the kind of most low-rent boomer take on a Facebook wall ever and print off all the sort of meaningful photos he's been hoarding for his life and stick them to the wall of the apartment. Do you remember this? It was, it struck me as pretty, I don't know, something about it. It really stuck out. Whether he was kind of trying to chronicle his life, he was trying to put something behind as some sort of legacy to it, or maybe he was just setting up a gallery of his own failures. And he acknowledges, well, this is Welbeck acknowledges in the book that, you know, Florent knows that after he's dead, the landlord's going to come in, think that's weird, and then hire a cleaner to clean up the glue.
Yeah, maybe that's like his point was he's just trying to make a mausoleum for himself, you know. But at the end of the day, someone's going to come down to, somebody's going to find him hanging from the bathroom and then just be like, lol, that's kind of strange that all these photos are up on the wall, and get somebody to tidy it up for him.
Yeah.
Sort of get what he's doing there because personal admission here, the most use my phone camera library ever got was probably my worst point of beauty. Because it is a thing that you do when you're really down, you'll reflect on things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was reading somewhere recently that it's the positive memories that you build during times, you know, when you're younger with your family or if you're kind of doing the right thing and da-da-da, that get you through the times when you're older. And when you are sick and in pain and when it's not so great anymore and that sort of stuff. And people who fail to build those up don't have those stores in reserve later on in life. And it's a very sort of miserable existence. I can't remember where I read it.
Start taking photos then, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Set yourself up your own boomer timeline.
Just have a selfie stick and be one of those obnoxious cunts walking around.
Upload it to the Google Cloud GUI. Make sure you keep that geotag on too.
So we're pretty much, it's in this apartment with the Robert's shooting the Uber Eats, and he makes a big point of saying that, you know, he turned the television on for the cooking shows and then got sick of that, so turned it off, and he never turns it back on. And the story finishes in quite an interesting... it's an unresolved ending. And I don't know whether you... that took much away from it. He kind of bangs on a little bit about, you know, being a bit of a shit of a thing if you're scientifically minded or you've had education in that area, because he can do the maths on the fall and he's figured out it's going to take him 4 seconds to hit the ground and his organs to, quote, explode, end quote, when he decides to finally end it all. And he kind of makes this point that he's so cerebral with everything. I don't know, that was part of me kind of not doxing, but having been through the tertiary system and all the rest of it, I could kind of relate to that. You know, there's sometimes when I just find it hard to get out of my own head, and I'd like to think that if I was ever in a situation that miserable, I would have, well, I'd never be in a situation like that. But yeah, I can see myself doing the same kind of thing, just overanalyzing, because you're already, you know, stressed and strapped and all the rest of it. Just kind of struck me as a really sort of actual vulnerable insight into Florence's unstable nature, but just the tragedy of the whole thing. So, now go on.
Oh, but it's left up in the air whether he actually goes through with it or not. You're not actually sure. At least that's what Democ and I sort of...
No, that's right. Yeah, it is. I think it is left totally up in the air. So the kind of closing notes of the book, he makes all these comparisons between himself and Christ, you know, because he's not narcissistic at all. And he says that, you know, it almost kind of breaks the fourth wall a little bit, saying that, you know, do I even have to do this for you? To the reader, I assume that maybe, you know, it's meant to be, I suppose, Florent talking to all the people in his life. He's trying to make sense of his own struggle. But yeah, it doesn't resolve. It doesn't tell you whether or not he takes the plunge or just keeps working on his timeline. Did you have anything from that more, Demon?
What I found interesting was that he held off until the very, very end, until the epilogue, after it leaves us wondering whether he committed suicide, to mention anything religious at all. Like maybe he dropped in a reference here or there somewhere in the book.
Yeah.
But one of the more interesting things was talking about how his love, I guess, for Kate and Camille, which nearly went somewhere, were like the will of God or a message from God, and that ultimately by not going through with either of them, it failed.
Yeah.
And that was his real failure, that he didn't get either of the women he loved when he had a shot to. Also, I think another quote I wrote down from Aymeric shortly before he went Waco on milk trucks was that I didn't organize these notes well, so I do have it written down somewhere. Essentially what he said was, okay, yeah, I think it's good to only have one chance. And I think that's a recurring theme through the book, that he doesn't get to do anything over.
And yeah, I hope that... No, go on.
Contrast between him and Aymeric, and the Aymeric ultimately, he has that outlook. Meanwhile, Florent is constantly lamenting that he had one chance and failed, and that Aymeric, although he did live a miserable life and get killed quite violently, he did achieve what he set out to do.
Yeah, I think that's... The sort of unresolved ending, but if you consider it in parallel with Aymeric's very sort of definite ending, I suppose it really does highlight their differences in character and the fact that, yeah, Florent sort of remains an utter failure and a sort of detached observer throughout pretty much the whole piece, and squanders the chances that he may have had in favor of chances that he believes the things that he should be doing or could be doing, or chasing 50 varieties of hummus without ever actually kind of putting down any real roots. But I suppose the real fly in the ointment is that Aymeric worked his whole life to try and do exactly that and also failed. So you know, who's the real enemy in the piece? If there is one, I reckon Florent's employer, the rest of the EU and the bureaucracy that are all suffering under, I guess. Would you kind of think the same thing, Sheepdog?
Yeah, 100%. That's like that's basically what's going on. It's, you know, faceless people who are unaccountable, causing, you know, human suffering to the people who actually, you know, make up the nation and who just got want to live their lives, essentially. Yeah.
Even the globalist types on their third wife.
I think it is a very important point that there's no names or descriptions given for any of these people, even though both Amaric and Florent both would have presumably dealt with them. They're left out completely because they are nameless and faceless.
Yeah.
Apart from maybe Florent himself, if you count him as part of it.
Yeah, I think he offers a sort of conduit between those two worlds, you know, the one that's basically wreaked all of this havoc. And he's almost, to use a pretty charged term, but he's almost kind of a refugee from that, or somebody that's always in that world. He's from it. He was specialized and benefited from it, and everything that he's doing is influenced by it, which offers you an insight through all of the interactions that he has with other people around him, and how they sort of reject him. So, yeah, I suppose that's Serotonin. So I
hope to cover for Movember, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sending out your men's health stuff. So on that point, the usually around this time on the show, we like to have a little bit of a call to action, a white pill in the tail end, something you can take home. So I don't know if anybody else had anything for this, but the one that I had was something that I kept thinking about in this book was, you know, there are times in the past when I've had different relationships with, like, whether it's food or alcohol or even pharmaceutical stuff at times, and it's really been a negative for me. Whether I knew it at the time or not, I eventually got wise to it, and I'm happy to say now that I'm, you know, clear of any of that, really. I don't struggle with any of it anymore, but it certainly hasn't been an easy road. But I suppose my call to action to all the listeners and other people out there would be, don't end up like Florent or Aymeric. If you got issues with, you know, weed or SRIs or any kind of pharmaceutical stuff or whatever, obviously don't be a dickhead. Just don't stop your medication tomorrow because some idiot on a podcast told you to. Do the right thing about it. But maybe have a look at the relationships you got with these things and decide whether or not you're going to kind of move forward with them in perpetuity. That's my call to action this time.
Yeah, weigh up the costs of the side effects of these things. Like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, for example, I think have a lot of side effects that, you know, that they make them sort of like crack, essentially. Like
absolutely. I mean, your dick doesn't work for a start.
That's one thing.
And if you cease them abruptly, yeah, they can carry the risk of suicide, which is ironic.
Exactly. So, and there's a lot of people in our particular demographic are already well down that road. I've got a few friends who are personally down that, and there's no going back once you set down that path. Before you start getting serious with them, what I would say is to take up a very well-regimented lifting regime and sort of stick to that. Because to be honest, I think I felt happier when I did that versus when I was on these fantastic drugs made probably in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I'd share that with you too. I quite literally lifted myself out of it. And it was only when I got serious about that and decided that I just wasn't going to do it anymore that I was able to, I suppose, yeah, wrest myself free of, a bit of a self-docs, but of the sort of pharmaceutical stuff that I've been involved with in the past. I'm totally clear of it now, but I certainly do look at some other people in my life and the box of pills doesn't get emptier. It just keeps filling up.
Yeah. And there's a reason behind that. It's to make you more placated and pliable and weak. So the only way to effectively combat it is, in my opinion, calisthenics.
Well, I would add to that, because there's more to than just lifting weights. Like you need, think of it like a table. a chair or something like that, and on top's your mental health. So you've got obviously the exercise, so you've got lifting, but you can do other things. Like, it doesn't have to just be that. You can play sport, run, just anything. You've also got diet, which if
diet has a huge component to it, and you can autistically focus or break down what you are doing with your food and stuff like that too. And I think that's kind of entertaining to an extent.
Well, some people are interested in diet, and that's one aspect. And then there's sleep. So if you're playing, I don't know, Dota till 5 in the morning, and then getting up at 5 in the afternoon, you're probably going to be depressed after a couple of weeks. And then, of course, you've got your personal relationships, whether that's with your family or like your friends and stuff. It's like actually going out and hanging out with, you know, the people who actually care about you, just to be reminded that people actually do care about you.
That's not to say, like, break crypto or anything like that, because that would probably have an inverse effect on your relationships.
As always with all things, you know, self-preservation is the highest consideration, which is, funnily enough, exactly what we're talking about with all of it. But, yeah, if you're going to make those sort of IRL connections and whatever, I mean, not to give you all the warm fuzzies, but this podcast has been great for me, and meeting you guys and the other people that I know involved in this thing and other IRL connections. As I flagged on, I think, previous episodes, saying, you know, go and try and make sort of IRL connections. I've since done so, and that's been really positive. It's something I'd encourage other people to do with all the sort of protections in place. Did you have anything else to round that off to, Mark?
No, I'd say that's a pretty complete set of advice for this week. Also, don't fail No Nut November for the other half of this.
Yeah, don't be a boomer.
Still going on that.
He almost said it, Mick. That was good. Almost got all the way to the end. So, yeah, thanks very much to Demok and Mick and our very special guest, Sheepdog, for joining us for this one.
Pleasure.
I've really enjoyed it. I enjoyed reading the book. Enjoyed is a bit of a funny word, but it's certainly going to stay with me. Mm. And also a quick shout-out, thanks to Bronce, who sadly didn't join us this time, but he will be producing it, so cheers for that. Now I suppose we'll go around the table. Did anyone have any plugs that they wanted to drop or things you want to recommend?
Once again, shout out to the Terry cast for somehow predicting exactly how I read books. That's mutuals.podbean.com, I believe. There'll be a link.
Nice, yep. Did you have anything to shoot, Doug?
No, not really. I mean, I don't know. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram if you want to, but
there you go. What's your handle? Do you want to break cover?
So my Instagram is sheep_dog17, so you'll find me there. If you can't find me, I don't know how to find you, so yeah. That's all I can do. And then I believe, I don't know, my Twitter's just sheepdog, I think. So yeah, that's it.
Cool. Well, I'm sure our listeners will check you out. And Mick, did you have anything good?
This is the Janny stream, which is pretty funny, I guess. Check it out.
Yeah, I think we've been waiting for an episode for a little while, but
you always miss the best episodes. Like, there's just something really strange on Q&A, and you just miss a week of it. That was the time.
That would have been a corker.
You know, like typhoons or bushfires or one of us is bored and wants to go to sleep early, so it is whatever. But yeah, sorry about that, fellas.
It's a shame you missed the feminist one. That would have been a doozy.
I would have like thrown my microphone at the wall.
Yeah, it's good watching though.
I don't know. That's all I really had to plug.
Cool. Yeah, well, I think I was gonna plug the Janny as well, but that's all fine. I feel it's important. I'll plug as well, I don't know if everyone's listening to it but or reading it, Quillette. So they had a really good thing on Welbeck, so that's a website, Quillette, and they've got a podcast there as well. So really good content there. Recommend you check it out if you like this kind of thing.
And just another thing too, if you like books, you should donate to Countercurrents, because they've just been showered from being able to process credit card payments. So now you have to mail them money or send them Bitcoin, which even I can't wrap my head around.
Holy moly.
Mm. And they've got some good content there. A lot of that stuff that they host on their website is stuff that I would like to review in future as well. So if you've got lots of neat bucks from working overtime in your wager cage, then, you know, do yourself a favor. By Tegan Olam, by Leo Yankovic, and also send an extra few shekels their way, because they could use it.
So on the topic of future stuff to review, next time we're all going to be looking at The Culture of Narcissism, American Life in an Age of Diminishing Expectations by Christopher Lash. Published 1979. Mm. At this stage, we're expecting to be joined by none other than Borzoi Boskovic of TRS fame. So he'd be known to his Twitter friends as Edward B. Chang.
Is that Chinese fella?
Yeah. So we're all pretty nervous about this one, but I'm sure it'll go pretty well. So, yeah, definitely.
he might convince me to sell my house to him in the podcast. We'll find out.
Or farm. So yeah, definitely tune in for that one. It'd be great. But thank you very much, everybody, for listening again. And that's all from me. How about you, Demog?
That's all from me too.
It's also all from me.
Hashtag me too.
All right, thanks very much, and we'll catch you next time.
Cheers, everyone.
So. We'll be right back.